It is actually a pleasure to be in the chair at this first meeting. When I was young, if you wanted to read about science and you weren't scientifically trained, you nevertheless read things written by people who were working scientists, people like Haldane and Huxley and Eddington and Jeans. There was one honourable exception, was H.G. Wells. Today we have a new profession of people who write about science who are actually scientists, who were trained as scientists, who know a great deal more about science than most working scientists. Of course, they can keep themselves informed of the subject, the rest of us can't. And our speaker today, Matt Ridley, is one of the best examples of this particular breed that has now appeared. However, I would rather emphasize that one shouldn't suppose, because somebody is thought of as a science writer, that they're not actually having original ideas about science. It's perfectly possible to write a readable book about science which actually contains new ideas. After all, The Origin of Species was a reasonably readable book, and there is a widely held view that it contained a new idea in there somewhere. I really do not think we should write off people who write, quote, popular books about science. They may very well contain new ideas. In any case, anybody who is brave enough to write a book and give a lecture on the origin of the virtue clearly has at least one virtue, and that is courage. Matt Ridley.
John, thank you very much indeed for that introduction. I'm not sure courage is the word so much as foolhardiness, but then one has to, as a writer, one has to make sure the books sell, so that's really why I'm here. Those of you who came to see new data had better wait till after tea, because I'm not going to give any new data. Those of you who came to see original work done by the person talking had better wait till then also. And those of you who came to see beautiful slides done by the person talking, I'm sorry, that comes after tea too, because I have beautiful slides, but they were made for me by my wife, Anya Halbert. I want to begin with two quotes that predate The Origin of Species by quite a long way and come actually from newspapers. I'm going to try and put it on the... I think it's probably easy. Oh, maybe it's not so easy for people to see. Would it be better if I had it on that screen?
Can that be made up?
Probably not. No. Yeah. I think that's just mine. They're on here too, so let's have a look. It's in the back. These are two quotes from newspapers in the 1840s. And I think they point up a rather interesting... contrast between two views of human nature. One comes from the Morning Post, and it said, "We do not suppose that the selfishness of human nature is ever to be overcome, but we would have all the laws and institutions of society so framed as to give it all possible discountenance." And responding to that article, someone wrote in The Economist a few weeks later, "The Post probably imagines, because laws and institutions are intended to promote the public benefit, that they make society, but a different philosophy represents society as the natural product of the instincts of individuals." What I hope you see from that two quotes is actually they're trying to contradict each other, but I think most of us would find it quite easy to agree with both of them. And I'm quite interested in the idea that the writer in The Economist is putting forward there, which is just as well because I worked for The Economist for 10 years. What I think he's trying to say is that we are generally happy to accept that selfishness is a natural and innate characteristic that society tries to overcome. We find it less easy to accept that some of the better sides of human nature may be just as natural and just as innate. And that's the idea that I want to explore this afternoon. Boiling down 2,000... It's too low, is it, for people to see? Shall I it's better if I put it there. Those of you at the back can see it up here, and those of you at the front can see it down there. Is that all right? Or neither of you can... None of you can see either. Can we raise that, do you think, a bit there? I'm getting a lot of shakes of the head at the back.
There's been lots of helpers around here.
Isn't there a knob on the side?
Lower. That's something knob, isn't it? Raising it at the bottom.
Yeah.
On the bottom. No, the bottom of the stand.
Hey, good.
Yes.
What about at the back?
A bit of focusing.
Well, I hope you all have time to read that now. If you boil down 2,000 years of philosophy into one slide, this is roughly what you come up with. Why are human beings so social? Why do they live in complex societies with sophisticated divisions of labour among them? And I think in the end you can try and categorise the answers into two kinds. Because we're naturally nice, which perhaps the best exponent of this is Jean-Jacques Rousseau, arguing that that human being, that the noble savage was essentially corrupted by modern civilization, an idea that recurs very prominently in the thinking of many modern environmentalists, that that on the whole people lived in harmony with nature until something came along and corrupted them later. But it's not confined to, as it were, the left of the political spectrum. On the far right of the political spectrum, in Hayek, you find a very similar idea when he argues that it was not until we learnt to be selfish sometime in the late Stone Age that human beings were able to invent the modern functioning economy. I'm trying to categorise here people who say that niceness comes first. And on the other side of the argument, there's an equally strong tradition arguing that we're essentially nasty, brutish and short until we overcome our worst instincts. St. Augustine's doctrine of original sin being one such example. Hobbes, of course, argued that human beings live in a continual state of war against all until morality is imposed from above. St. Augustine said it came from God, Hobbes said it came from the sovereign. And I would argue, perhaps tongue-in-cheek a bit, that modern Brussels bureaucrats tend to take the view that unless we're surrounded by sufficient rules and regulations, we are basically evil. So before I go on to argue that human cooperative and social instincts, the better sides of our human nature, are indeed instincts, I need to perhaps persuade you that it's worth using the word instincts in conjunction with human beings at all. I don't have any problem thinking that we are motivated by instincts, because I don't have any problem thinking of instincts as being very flexible things. You can argue that perhaps I'm not using the word in the right sense of the word there, but I don't think there's another word that expresses what I'm trying to say. Clearly, there are very basic things we share with a lot of animals, like hunger and so on, that are perfectly pre-programmed automatic instincts, and I don't think anyone would argue with that. There are slightly more complicated things where there is an element of learning, but nonetheless it's easier to learn some things than others. I think it was Robert Hind who explained to me how experiments with monkeys show that you can teach them to be frightened of snakes much more easily than you can teach them to be frightened of other things. Essentially, they are predisposed to learn fear of snakes. They're not born with the fear of snakes. They do have to learn it. But they will learn to fear snakes much more easily than they will learn to fear something else. Steven Pinker has made the case that language is an instinct. Now, obviously, language isn't an instinct in the sense that we're born with it fully formed, whether it's Hebrew or English or whatever. But it is an instinct in the sense that we're born with the capacity to develop the capacity to learn a language, a grammatical language. And that's the sense in which I'm trying to use the word instinct here. Because I think when nature and nurture are pushing in the same direction, i.e. when you're using your nurture to try and reinforce the way your nature wants to go, then it's very difficult to distinguish between them. and that when people try and parcel out nature and nurture, they're assuming, without realizing it implicitly, that nature and nurture are pulling in opposite directions, and they very rarely are. So what I'm going to argue today is that there is a human instinct for social exchange, or economic exchange, any kind of exchange, on which our societies have been built, and that there are some intriguing new things that we might be able to say about it. What is the point of living in society? What is the point of being a social creature? On the whole, with remarkably few exceptions, I think it boils down to one phrase, the division of labour. Of course, if you're a bird and you're living in a flock of birds, there are other things like protection from predators and so on, and safety in numbers. But I'm talking about really very complex societies, societies with a lot of social cooperation and interaction. And the point for us of living in society is quite clearly that we're able to exploit divisions of labour. Adam Smith made this point 200 years ago, so it's not a new one, and nobody has really either contradicted him or even added to what he said very interestingly in the last 200 years. But the point of a division of labour is that it can make 2 plus 2 equal 5. In Adam Smith's example of a factory of pin makers, he's making the case that an individual could never be be as productive if he had to make his own pins as he could if he relied on specialists to make them for him. If I had to get out of bed every morning and not only make my own food, but grow it and prepare it, find my own clothing, design my own entertainment and everything else, I would simply not find enough hours in the day to fill my life. And yet I am able to fill my life with all of those things, and the answer is because each of us specializes, and specialists bringing together the products of their specialization are more effective than individuals trying to be self-sufficient. Exactly the same argument can be made for the function of social living in ants, bees, naked mole rats, and other highly social vertebrates. And the societies of ants and bees and naked mole rats have often been described as superorganisms, analogous with bodies and organisms. But of course, that's the wrong way around. The point is not that an ant colony is like a body. The point is that bodies are colonies. Bodies are colonies of cells, which have decided to get together and express a division of labor between them and function as a society. Your liver cell and your skin cells and so on have a very effective division of labor between them. If you didn't have that, you'd never be able to compete with bacteria, who are much more metabolically efficient and rapid at what they do. And you go one level deeper and look inside the cell, and you find that it is a society of organelles, that the nucleus and the mitochondria and the endoplasmic reticulum, etc., express a sort of division of labor within the cell. You can go still deeper and point out that the genome, or at least each chromosome, is itself, it consists of individual specialists all working towards the whole, but dividing labor among themselves. John Maynard Smith made this point very beautifully in his book, The Major Transitions in Evolution, and argued that the invention of these various forms of social cooperation mark major transitions from one kind of organization to another in the fossil record. Looking at human divisions of labor in a little more detail, we clearly have all sorts of different forms of division of labor, and some are more ancient and more pervasive than others. But I think it is widely established and agreed by anthropologists that there is a division of labor between the sexes in most hunter-gathering societies, something I'll come back to in a minute. There's a rather interesting idea put forward in a new book coming out this month called Born to Rebel by Frank Sulloway of Harvard, who argues that siblings essentially try to separate their niches within the family by developing their characters in different directions from other siblings in order to find a vacant niche within the family, as he puts it, almost as if they're trying to find some specialisation that's different from other members of the family. His argument is that the younger siblings are much more rebellious as a result than elder siblings. But it seems to me in passing that he's talking about something rather similar to a division of labour within the family. Perhaps what we mostly think of as a division of labour is the division of labour between individual artisans, between pin makers and their consumers and so on, which I call here between colleagues, which isn't perhaps quite the best word, but still. But then there's another human division of labour, which is the division of labour between groups, where you get one whole group that is specialising in one activity and another whole group that will specialise in a different activity. I personally think this is just about unique to human beings. I'm not sure you can find examples of this in the animal kingdom. You do get groups that do different things, but you don't get exchange between them. We call it trade, but that's essentially what it is. Trade is the expression of a division of labour between groups. Just to go back to the sexual division of labour for a second, I was trying to think of examples of other animals which express a permanent division of labour between the male and the female. And you can think of quite a lot of temporary divisions of labour between males and females in terms of building nests or feeding the female on the nest or something like that. But the only permanent one that I can think of is the huia bird, which is sadly now extinct, which lived in New Zealand, and which went around the forest in pairs. And the male and female had very different anatomy on their beaks. The male has a short chisel-like beak with which it chiseled into the wood for insects, and the female had a much longer, more slender, curved beak with which she probed for insects. And it was said that if you kept a pair of huia birds in captivity and one died, the other would pine away and die simply because it couldn't live without the other. The two worked together as a team. My point is not that there's anything particularly interesting or exciting about huia birds, but that examples like this are really very rare. And yet, in human beings, we have the expression of male hunting and female gathering being widely agreed to be universal in hunter-gatherers. There are very, very few exceptions, and they tend to be ones that prove the rule. In other words, where females hunt, it tends to be for small animals that are captured in the same way as you would gathering. And when males gather food, it tends to be scattered, widely distributed food of the kind that you gather in the same way as you would hunting. And this sexual division of labour may indeed be something of ecological significance to the survival of our species on the African savannah during the Pleistocene, because it's difficult to see how a large primate living in large groups could have got through a couple of million years on the savannah, living on either plant food or animal food alone. The advantage of gathering both is that you get the reliability of the plant food with the quality of the animal food. On the whole, meat is higher in protein and vitamins and so on. But when times are short, or if the hunter comes back hungry, you can fall back on the much more staple food gathered by females. Now, this may or may not be of the ecological significance I'm investing it with, but it gives you an example of how the two sexes in this case, by combining the produces of their work, end up both being better off. However, there's one division of labour that we don't show, and most other social organisations do show it, and that's the reproductive division of labour. In ants and bees and wasps, reproduction is delegated to the queen. In slime moulds, which this is an example here, there's a particularly nice case of social cooperation, because slime moulds are curious creatures, neither fungi nor amoebae, but somewhere in between. They live most of the time as individual cells within rotting wood. They come together when times are hard and form a sort of slug-like thing that moves about. And if times get very hard, the slug will send up a stalk. And on top of the stalk will grow a spore, a sporidium, from which spores will be distributed across the countryside. And the point here is that if you are an amoeba and you join in this business, then you're either going to end up in the stalk or you're going to end up in the sporidium. And if you're in the sporidium, then you inherit the earth, and if you're in the stalk, you die. So it's a very clear reproductive division of labor, that the stalk cells are sacrificed to the good of the others. And it's, in a sense, quite a problem to explain why any cell would ever be a stalk. But of course, the answer, we all know, is very obvious, and the man who worked it out is sitting in the front row, Bill Hamilton, that kin selection explains reproductive divisions of labor, because if two individuals are extremely closely related, then genetically speaking, it doesn't matter which does the reproducing, so long as the genes get reproduced into the next generation. So a reproductive division of labor is almost essential to building up the kind of sophisticated cooperation that you see in, for example, a body, whereby all the organs work together for the common good, but only the ovaries or the testicles get any share of posterity. And we do not, as human beings, have a reproductive division of labor in our societies. As I said, other social animals do. We don't delegate reproduction to the queen. Although we have celibate castes in our societies, such as Catholic bishops, we on the whole, don't pay them an awful lot of attention. I want to try and draw throw a roadblock in what I've just been saying now, which is, if these advantages that I've been talking about, if these divisions of labour are so obvious and so helpful, and social living has all these advantages, then A, why doesn't everybody do it? And B, how can it be done if we're all self-interested? Because in 1776, Adam Smith told us we were essentially motivated by self-interest as individuals, that a baker does not sell you a loaf of bread because he wants to do you a favor. He sells you a loaf of bread because he wants the money, and you buy the loaf of bread not because you want to do him a favor, but because you want the bread. So in other words, we're, on the whole, most human behavior boils down to self-interest. And exactly 200 years later, in 1776, Richard Dawkins comes along and says, well, it's not quite like that. It's actually genetic self-interest that we're talking about here. Other people said it too, but Richard's book happens to have been published 200 years after Adam Smith, so it's quite a neat thing. We're not just individually self-interested, because we often do behave altruistically, as when we look after our children, but when we're doing so, we're behaving genetically selfishly, even if we're being individually selfless. If that's the case, then how can we surrender this? How can we make egotists cooperate? How can we get to these advantages that I've outlined of divisions of labor in society? And this isn't an idle objection, because if you look at the cases that I've listed, you do find very clear mutinies, very clear expressions of selfishness happening within those societies that I've talked about. In the case of worker bees, for example, worker bees are not obligately celibate. They can reproduce, and they quite often try. And the reason they fail is because other workers detect that they've laid eggs and kill those eggs by smelling them and recognizing that they're different. If a honeybee queen were to mate with only one drone, the worker bees would all be quite closely related to each other, and they would not have the same self-interest in suppressing this mutiny in killing each other's eggs. That happens in bumblebees, and as a result, of bumblebee colonies quite quickly have a lot of queens in them. My point is that you do have to have mechanisms like polyandry in honeybees to suppress mutiny of selfishness within the society. And after all, what is cancer but another organ of the body deciding to no longer restrain itself and leave reproduction to the gonads, but to go ahead and do it itself as vigorously as it can. Even better example comes from the meiotic drive genes, or segregation distorters and things like that, where there are alleles that refuse to accept the toss of the coin that determines which gene will go into the egg, and they bias the outcome of that process, and they have a 95% chance of that particular allele being in the egg. And there's a very nice story which various people have described about how segregation distorters and other meiotic drive genes are suppressed by and it's not an idle problem. It's one suggestion is that the whole of crossing over, the swapping of bits of chromosomes between chromosomes, is there simply to suppress meiotic drive genes. Well, of course, the archetypal paradigm for talking about getting egotists to cooperate is the prisoner's dilemma. I won't bore you, because most of you, whether economists or biologists, will know this very well, except to say, summarize very quickly by saying that in the prisoner's dilemma, it pays you as player one to defect whatever player two does, because if player two cooperates, you increase your score from 3 to 5. You probably can't read that at the back, but it says 3 and 5. By defecting, you increase your score from 3 to 5. But if he defects, you increase your score from 0 to 1 by defecting. So whatever he does, you're better off defecting. And yet, of course, he argues the same way, so you both end up defecting. You both get 1 when you could have had 3 points if you'd both cooperated. And that, in a nutshell, summarizes the problem of how you get egotists to cooperate. Ants and bees and bodies and things like that don't mind about this problem, because they're quite happy for one individual to defect, that is the queen, and all the others to cooperate, that is to be exploited by the queen, reproductively speaking. So they're quite happy up in this corner scoring 5 points. As long as somebody gets the 5 points, they don't mind who it is. So essentially that's where I think kin selection paradigms fit into the prisoner's dilemma. But human societies, as I said, do not have the reproductive division of labour. And so they are, as it were, striving to end up in this corner of mutual benefit, where both individuals are benefiting from the cooperation within society. And how do they do it? Well, the most popular answer recently has been that we do it through reciprocity. This was first suggested by Bob Trivers in the early 70s, that a good deal of cooperation in certainly primates and particularly human beings might be based upon tit for tat, reciprocation of favours. And Robert Axelrod came along in the early 80s and did a series of computer tournaments playing the prisoner's dilemma, where computer programs quite quickly show that if the game goes on for an indefinite number of times, it doesn't make sense to defect, it makes sense to cooperate, but to defect when the other guy defects. In other words, to reciprocate, to play the strategy of tit for tat. And there's a huge literature on that has developed much, much further than that story, but basically the basic message remains the same, that reciprocation can produce cooperation between two individuals playing a prisoner's dilemma game. So zoologists went out of the field to look for reciprocity in the early 80s and late 70s and have been doing so ever since, and they've come back with very, very few examples. Some people may disagree with that assertion, but I feel that for the effort that's gone into looking for tit for tat in social animals, the rewards have been remarkably meagre. The best example is, of course, the vampire bat study by Gerald Wilkinson in Costa Rica, where bats have a very high failure rate looking for blood meals at night, and they come back to the roost and beg for food off their neighbours. And the neighbours know that they may end up failing to get blood themselves in the future, whether they know that or not. But anyway, they do have that. So it makes sense for them to be generous. And sure enough, it turns out that vampire bats that are not generous tend to be punished by their neighbours when their turn comes to ask for a blood meal. Likewise, Frantz de Waal's experiments show that there are clear signs of reciprocity. If you scratch my back, I scratch yours. Within the chimpanzee society, that individuals tend to remember who's been nice to them, who's been nasty to them, and that way to build cooperative relationships. And the work of Richard Connor and others off Western Australia has shown much the same thing in bottlenose dolphins, with the wrinkle that in the dolphins, the cooperation, the reciprocity is not so much between individuals as between small groups of individuals. In this case, groups of males who try to kidnap females from other groups of males, and they solicit help in doing so from a third group of males, and the third group of males will ask for the favour to be returned at some future stage. Now, the remarkable, the coincidental thing about all three of those examples is that they are the largest brained creatures in their order, except for the chimpanzees, where we are slightly larger brained. And vampire bats actually stand out as having very large neocortexes compared to the rest of their brain among bats, chimpanzees ditto among apes, and bottlenose dolphins among cetaceans. So there does seem to be some point here that the reason why you would not see a lot of reciprocity in other animals would be because it simply requires too much processing power, remembering who's been nice to who, and you would not expect to find that in animals that don't have very large neocortexes. There is fairly good evidence of reciprocity in human beings too. I mean, we don't have to think very hard about our own lives to realise the extent to which we do return favours and bear grudges against those who don't return favours and so on. I think one of the best examples of a game that shows this, if you like, is the ultimatum bargaining game, and in particular the work that Vernon Smith at the University of Arizona has been doing with it. For those of you who don't know the game goes like this. Adam, I'm the experimenter, I give Adam £10 and tell him to divide it with Bob. He offers Bob a share of the £10. Bob can refuse the money or accept it, but he can't do anything else. He can't suggest a different division of the sum. If he accepts the offer, they both get what they've agreed. If he refuses the offer, neither get anything. They have to give the money back to me. Now, the question is, how much should Adam offer Bob? And the logical answer is one penny. Because Bob can't do anything about getting more from Adam. He can simply refuse or accept it. And then at least he's a penny better off, whereas if he refuses the offer, he's no better off. Adam has... it makes sense for Adam, therefore, to keep the bulk of the money. But of course, if you play this game, nobody playing Adam offers one penny. Or if he does, he's given a pretty quick raspberry and sent away by Bob. Bob refuses the money in disgust. And it turns out that most people who play Adam tend to offer about sort of £4.50, you know, about 45% of the money, which they think will be just about enough to buy Bob's acquiescence, which is a very generous thing of them to do. But you can see why they're not offering more, and that's because they think Bob will refuse them. Robert Frank argued that this showed a sort of innate sense of fairness in us, that we do care about fairness, whichever side of the argument we're on. But I think Vernon Smith's experiments put it in a slightly different light, because what he did was change the rules of the game in various ways. One way he did it was by setting them a general knowledge test before the experiment began, and the one who came top got to play Adam, and the one who came bottom got to play Bob. And in those circumstances, Adam was less generous, because he felt he'd earned the right to have a share of the money. to have to decide his share, and therefore he decided to keep more for himself. He then did a series of other experiments. In one of them, how did it work? Well, in one of them, he kept he made it anonymous, so the experimenter didn't know who was playing Bob, who was playing Adam, arguing that perhaps the chap who was playing Adam was actually trying to impress the experimenter with his generosity. And indeed, Adam is much less generous in those circumstances. He thinks he can get away with it, and he might be asked back to the experimenter in future. But if you're ever in Arizona, it's a very profitable thing to do, to get asked to be a subject in Vernon Smith's lab. The point is that all of these experiments that Vernon Smith did tended to show that it's not, we don't have some innate sense of fairness. We're quite quick to abandon a feeling of fairness if the opportunity arises. But we do have a very innate sense of reciprocity. We're tending quite quickly to spot opportunities to protect our reputation for trustworthiness, generosity, and so on. However, I think we've been barking up the wrong tree with reciprocity a bit. And I think the reason is partly a semantic one. If you ask an anthropologist what he means by reciprocity, he doesn't mean the return of favours and the bearing of grudges. He means exchange of different items. In other words, what I've been talking about so far is entirely in terms of exchange of the same good at a different time, which is something we don't actually have that many opportunities to do. We don't, if someone does us a favour, it's not necessarily automatic that quite quickly, within a week or two, we'll have a chance to return the same favour. A much, much more common problem, or opportunity, I should say, is that we have something that somebody else wants and somebody else has something that we want. In other words, rather than exchange of the same good at a different time, exchange of different goods at the same time, which is what anthropologists mean by reciprocity. And let's just to clear up the semantics, let's call that exchange from now on, and let's use reciprocity for what I've been talking about. Exchange is something that there are much greater opportunities for in human society, as I think we can immediately see. And if two individuals exchange things, that they can benefit from the exchange, essentially boils down to David Ricardo's law of comparative advantage, which has been described as the only position to come out of the social sciences that is both true and surprising, but that's perhaps unfair. What Ricardo noticed was that if, let's say, we have two individuals, Adam and Bob. Adam takes an hour to make a stone axe and 2 hours to make a spear. Bob takes 4 hours to make an axe and 3 hours to make a spear. So Adam is better than Bob at making both of them. So comparatively, you would think that it would make sense for Adam to make both his own spears and his own axes. But if you think about it for a minute, it becomes immediately obvious that Adam can get his spears by making an extra axe and swapping it for one of Bob's spears, which would only take him 2 hours instead of the 3 hours it would take him to make one of each. And Bob is better off with this too, because in the example I've chosen, Bob is better at making spears than he is at making axes. Now, substitute for Adam Japan and Bob Britain, and you get straight into the economic arguments for free trade that have been rumbling ever since Ricardo started them in the 18-teens. But that's not the avenue I want to go down today, because I want to keep the focus on exchange among individuals, although it is true that exchange between groups can also be seen in this light. The point is simply to demonstrate how numerous and ample the opportunities for benefiting from exchange can be among individuals of different skills and abilities. And that leads me finally to a hypothesis at last, which you'll be glad to hear, rather than simply reporting other people's work. Unfortunately, it's not my own hypothesis. It's 220 years old. I think it's been overlooked, and I think it's an interesting one. And it's a throwaway remark by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, in which he suggests that human beings specialise among individuals and animals don't. Other animals don't. Each animal, he wrote, is still obliged to support and defend itself separately and independently, and derives no sort of advantage from that variety of talents with which nature has distinguished its fellows. Among men, on the contrary, the most dissimilar geniuses are of use to one another, the different produces of their respective talents, by the general disposition to trap, barter, and exchange, being brought, as it were, into a common stock, where every man may purchase whatever part of the produce of the other men's talents he has occasion for. What Smith, I think, is saying is that every rabbit has to do the whole repertoire of rabbity things. Because you can't get some of your rabbity things from another rabbit. You have to run away from predators yourself, you have to find food yourself, you have to, etc., etc. Whereas we human beings don't behave like that. We specialise very early in our lives in one small area of human activity and use the surplus to exchange it for the specialisations of others. Now, we tend to think of this as something really rather recent and modern, but I don't think we have any evidence for that at all. In fact, evidence for divisions of labour within human societies is obviously very scanty, but evidence for trade among societies that did different things, it goes back at least 30,000, 40,000 years, possibly longer, and I find it very hard to believe that sitting on the savannah a million years ago, my ancestors were still desperately trying, each individual, to be self-sufficient and hadn't figured out, as it were, that that guy's better at making stone tools, so I'll give him some meat because I'm better at hunting, and he'll give me a tool to do the hunting with because I'm not very good with my hands. In other words, I see no reason why a division of labour within society could not be a very ancient thing, because we suspect we've been living in complex societies for a very long time. And if it is an ancient thing, if it's been going on for hundreds of thousands or millions of years, then it may have left its mark on our brains. And what I'd like to suggest is that if you look at human adolescents, they do actually show a tremendous tendency to concentrate on what they're good at and make themselves even better at it, to specialise, in other words. Whether one is good at sport or whether one is good at music or something like that, there will be a tendency to follow up what you're... All you need to do is have a program in your head that says find out what you're good at and do more of it so you'll get even better at it, and you will tend to show a much greater degree of specialisation within the society. If that happens, I think it's quite feasible that we may find that there is a difference in the way our brains are built from those of most other primates, because you would expect, therefore, the brain to be a little more plastic to allow the thing you're good at to colonise slightly more of the cortex. The bit of my brain devoted to catching balls is obviously very small, because I'm very bad at it, and so on. I suspect that that is where this hypothesis at last, I suppose, gets testable. And on that point, and over to you scientists to test it, I leave it with you. Thank you very much indeed.
I'm going to ask our speaker to feel his own questions because I'm too short-sighted to see them. But it would be nice when you ask a question, you don't have to have a microphone or anything, apparently everything is bugged. But do say who you are and where you come from, if you remember.
I'm Richard Hall, member of the public. There is some reciprocity in chimpanzees about sharing. Means there is any form of trading there. I mean, presumably some chimpanzees are better hunting. Chimpanzees are better hunting monkeys than others are, and there might be a basis for trading there.
Yeah, I'll repeat the question in case you didn't hear it at the back. Some chimpanzees are better at hunting monkeys than others, there may therefore be trading going on within chimpanzees. Yes, certainly, I would accept that there is exchange as well as reciprocity going on in chimpanzee society. You know, it's quite clear from the experiments of the Japanese group in the Mahale Mountains in Tanzania that they give an example of one particular alpha male who uses monkey meat, which he catches when he kills a monkey, to buy favours in the troop in various ways. I mean, he cultivates his grassroots support, as it were, with meat. Yes, I'm sure that goes on, but you do not see regular food sharing happening the whole time at every meal like you do in human beings, in other apes. There's a rather nice little anecdote, which may or may not mean anything, from Biruti Galdikas's book on orangutans, where she brought her daughter up with some orphan orangutans who were of exactly the same age, as it were, and she compared their behaviour a bit. And one of the things that struck her was that her daughter was always wanting to share food, whereas the orangutan young would always grab food and run away with it. I don't know whether that means anything or not, but it's sort of the way I would expect it to go.
John Dupre, philosophy at Birkbeck. I'd just like you to say a bit more about this hypothesis at the end, and particularly you said these are maybe testable. And the first thing that struck me when you said it is, you say about adolescents tending to find out what they're good at and pursue it, but of course there are huge incentives in society as divided, as labour divided as ours, I suppose whole careers, whole institutions of career advisory specialists and so on, encouraging this, and I wonder what would provide evidence for some kind of biological basis for this, rather than just evidence for something that we have learned to be able to do, which is pretty clearly.
Yes, I mean, I take your point. To repeat the question, there's a tremendous amount of careers pressure and other things on us to in our very divided labour societies, modern societies, to specialise. How would one begin to test the idea that it might have a biological basis, given that? Is that roughly a summary of what you said? I mean, I think part of my point is that just because modern society is pushing in one direction doesn't mean that it's not pushing with biology, so which I'm sure you accept. To go back to the question of how you make it testable, I mean, I think one thing that would be valuable would be to, there's a lot of interest in hunter-gatherer groups all around the world, groups who are living in societies of the size and scale and technological sophistication that we think may echo, it's always problematic, because of the influences of the outside world. And I think, it would be interesting to compare the extent to which an adolescent in such a society does tend to specialise in one thing rather than another. Leda Cosmides and John Tooby have gone out to test have adapted their Waisson test experiment, which is also a social exchange one I didn't mention, into a form that they can go and do in Ecuador with the Achua people, and to see whether they get the same sorts of results as they get in pecuniary Western societies. That's one thing. The question of whether skills colonize the brain in the same in a slightly greedy way at the expense of other skills is something that I would have thought a neuroanatomist might be able to begin to shed light on, particularly in these days of, I'm looking at my wife to try and remember what the name is, but magnetic resonance imaging and PET and PET scanning and all that kind of thing. I would have thought that you could begin to say much more interesting things about localization within the brain now with these new technologies. That's another thought. But I never was any good at experiments, so I'm not really suggesting how to test it well.
John Watkins in this case. But suppose there wasn't John Watkins, but Adam Smith or something. He just seems to be a literature. And I asked for a question. I said, you did a very nice exposition of my account, my pre-Darwinian account. I haven't heard of this term until quite recently. Could you please tell me what you, with your been any?
It's a very good question. I think you all heard it, did you? Well, and one thing you can add is I don't think Adam Smith had even the glimmerings of the beginnings of an explanation of why we're nice to our children.
Why
we are nice to our children. I mean, I think, you know, economists had to assume that we're nice to our children because they'd be pretty stupid to assume otherwise. But if that is, just to take one example, that is something that is a patently obvious piece of irrational altruism, if you like, that pervades our society. There's no rational basis in classical economics for being nice to your kid.
I just thought, if I'm asked, why don't you eat them? Education
and so on. I thought
I've
got a sort of eye about work forward, my old age, and I'm off to help on the farm. Yes, well, why do you. Yes. Yes, no, okay. I mean, there are utilitarian explanations, but I don't think any of them are nearly as good as the kin selection explanation. That in the end, we're nice to our children, and alligators are nice to their babies, even though they're. You know, protect their babies as soon as they nest, even though they're not going to get any help on the farm later in life. You know, I think the universal zoological explanation that the individuals are nice to their children because they are motivated by genetic selfishness to be selfless in that relationship is a very convincing and powerful one. That's just one example, but I'm not trying to. I don't think that the evolutionary biologists should gallop into economics on a white horse and say, you guys got it all wrong, here's the answer. Quite the reverse. I think evolutionary biology has a lot to learn from the fact that some of the things it's been saying have been argued about by economists and philosophers for a very long time. And that was part of the reason why I started with those two quotes from the Morning Post and the Economist, because they're 12 years before Darwin. And yet they're arguing about where selfishness and unselfishness comes from in individuals' breasts. Very, very similar to the sorts of arguments you see going on in evolutionary biology today. Jeffrey.
Jeffrey Miller, UCL. If we have an instinct for specialization, there are actually two opposite kinds of predictions one can make with respect to psychology. One kind of psychologist would say, this is the reason for having a domain general learning mechanism that could shape us to do anything well. A different kind of psychologist could say, well, there's stable sort of social niches or exchange niches that might last a long time, and that might select for heritable differences in personalities and skills that might be reinforced through a sort of mating principle. So one could deduce either a kind of general purpose psychology to support specialization, or a very domain-specific psychology with big heritable personality differences to support specialization. Which kind of route would you want to go down?
That paradox only occurred to me when someone asked a similar question after a similar talk a couple of weeks ago, and I think it's a very interesting one, i.e. that you can almost derive opposite predictions out of the idea that I'm suggesting. My feeling is that if you go around and sort of pick all the people in this room and say this little bit at the back of the brain, what's it doing? You might find that it's doing slightly different things in each of us. And I would say that's consistent with what I'm saying, because in some people it's been colonized by one of the things they're good at, which is different from what the chap sitting next door is good at. And therefore that bit of the brain's been colonized by a different skill. And you would therefore say that brain function is less localized than in a monkey or something like that. And of course you'd be wrong, because it might be just as localized, it's just that the boundaries are apt to shift in our brain, something like that. I gather from neuroscientists that the localization is finer in our brains, in the sense that there's more different skills crammed into the same area. But that's not necessarily inconsistent with what I'm talking about. As for the heritability point, that you would expect sort of major differences between individuals according to genetic inheritance and so on. I hadn't really thought that one through, and I think it's certainly an intriguing one. There's no question that skills are heritable, that musicians, well, maybe there is a question, I don't know, that musicians have an element of, you know, who are, the Bach family had good music genes as well as good music skills in it. It didn't have to have only one or the other, it could have had both. Not quite sure where that gets you. Sorry, I'm petering out here, but can be continued.
Tony Thurston-Pikes from Imperial College. From what I gathered, you drew the distinction between reciprocity and exchange by looking at the prisoner's dilemma and the comparative advantage game as two different forms of social interaction. Would you agree that even in the comparative advantage game, there is a form of prisoner's dilemma, which is that I would always prefer to give the guy a dud spear in exchange for a good for a good piece of meat, and that you therefore, even by looking at exchange, you don't avoid the various problems that the repeated prisoner's dilemma throws up, and that at least on some accounts inadequately solved by the Axelrod tournament.
That's a very good point, actually. But yes, I mean that even in the comparative advantage game, although you're getting the you're mutually benefiting from the exchange, there is still a free rider opportunity which you have to counter by a suspicious attitude towards building up trust, sort of thing. Is that summarising what you're saying? We're essentially straight back into Axelrod.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good point. I hadn't thought along those lines. And yes, I don't think that perhaps was quite the hard and fast distinction between exchange and reciprocity that I was making it, but I do think that that it is a conflation of two slightly different ideas, and that it does help a bit to separate them. You said something right at the end, which I thought I wanted to say add something to, and I can't remember what it was.
Well, right, I was just suggesting that the Axelrod tournaments, at least on many opinions, don't actually show the cooperation is the equilibrium repeated solution. To prisoner's dilemmas.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, a pure tit for tat is not a ESS. I think I'm right saying John.
No, they tell me.
but you get into generous tit for tat and Pavlov and I don't know whether Martin Novak's here, but you know, people like that. But there's a sort of feel of reciprocity about those strategies would be my answer.
And there's nasty ones that also survive, and rather nasty ones that survive, like. The fact whenever you have someone that looks relatively nice.
Certainly the you know, much the most realistic game is the optional prisoner's dilemma. The game in which you have the opportunity to say, I don't like, look at this guy, I'm not going to play with him. And Robert Frank's beautiful little experiment where he put a dozen people in a room and said, get to know each other for half an hour. And then at the end of half an hour, he asked them individually, he said, of those people back in that room, which one do you think is going to cooperate and which one's going to defect in the prisoner's dilemma? And they were far better than chance at predicting which one would. So we're terribly attuned to discriminating between potential cooperators and potential defectors. And that's a very large part of our social skills, is looking for opportunities of that kind. I think that's certainly true. What I didn't say, and perhaps should have done, is that reciprocity has a big theoretical problem as being the glue of complex societies, which is that it works much better in pairwise relationships than in large groups. The larger the group, the bigger the free riding opportunities, and the harder it is to get the maths to come out right, as it were. I think to some extent the same applies to exchange. Because of the point you were making about the opportunities for free riding, and it is very interesting that in societies, hunter-gatherer societies where there is trade, like Yanomamo and so on, trade between groups, where one group tends to make baskets and the other tends to make fish hooks, and they exchange the two. each individual in one society has a trading partner in the other society with whom he builds up a relationship of trust. So there is sort of man-to-man trading, even though it's expressing a group difference. And you can immediately see why that would be the case. You know, I'm only going to do a deal with Bob because we've dealt with each other for years. We know, I know that he's not going to give me dud fish hooks or whatever. I'm surrounded. Clive.
Clive Crook, also from The Economist, he's embarrassed to say. You said very little about virtue in your talk, much less than in the book. So I wasn't going to have asked a question I had ready to ask until you provoked me by what you said about why we nice to our children, the kin selection and much better explanation of the theories. The question provokes me to ask is, do you think, you've already said that evolutionary biology can get on very happy with economics, which is something I have no difficulty in accepting, but do you also think, as you seem to imply at some point in the book, that evolutionary biology abolishes moral philosophy?
Do I say that?
I didn't say it, but you're going to now.
Philosophers, to help you, the philosophers would want to quarrel, I think, with the idea that the only reason we're nice to our children is because our genes tell us to be nice to our children.
Yes. If I water down my claim a bit and say that it would be wrong for moral philosophy to ignore the discoveries of evolutionary biology, that they do add something to the debate. And therefore, everything that's gone before is not necessarily wrong, but it's not sufficient. Had Plato known about selfish genes, he might have made a different point. I think most people would be happy with that, that as the debate goes on, discoveries in science can influence philosophy because they bring new knowledge to bear as opposed to simply new thinking power or something like that. I'm sure a lot of philosophers wouldn't object to that. I think in the end, you're right, you've smoked me out, I'm a gene-tilitarian. I think in the end we're doing things for reasons of enlightened genetic self-interest, which is what a utilitarian, I think, would say you're doing it for enlightened self-interest. And enlightened genetic self-interest seems to me a very important new wrinkle on that, one that I think has a lot of explanatory power. But, God, you put me in a room with real moral philosophers and make me defend that against their opposing view, and I might buckle.
I do think that just if I can just follow very briefly, the subtext of an awful lot of sociobiology, it's far less strident in your book than most. But it does seem to me that the subtext is that moral philosophers are simply deluding themselves. And we delude ourselves when we ask, in the normal way, questions about what's right and wrong. But we think we're approaching that in some sort of objective or disinterested way. And in fact, we are programmed. To use Dawkins' term, we're robots blundering towards a solution that we're programmed to arrive at in any case. And I just wonder whether you were willing to sort of wholeheartedly endorse that view of our moral capacities, or whether you thought it was more too.
I still think that you and I can shake off the shackles of programs and be objective about things. I think we've got to be much more aware of the fact that when we're thinking we're objective, we're actually just expressing a different program, if you like. I think there's no harm in being aware of the problem, that what we think of as objectivity isn't necessarily so. I don't think free will and objectivity are totally destroyed by this, by no means. No, I think that's naive, because I think, apart from anything else, we haven't yet worked out what all these programs, what all these non-objectivities are saying. A lot of them are pushing in contrary directions, and so on.
Right. But that's only to say that the project of abolishing moral philosophy is not yet complete.
I just wonder if I see Bill Hamilton trying to come in, I suspect on the point you're making, and he might make a better fist of this than me.
I wanted to say to the moral philosopher who objects to the sociobiological interpretation of whaleanites to our children and says he's got other explanations, etc. He at least should. No, the moral philosopher who objects to the sociobiological interpretation of whaleanites to our children. One thing which he could be asked is, why is it that people object to baby swapping experiments? It's not just a question of being nice to any child, it's a question that we are nice to particular children who are our own. And I suspect that the moral philosopher can have a little more difficulty explaining why we're not content with the idea that babies will be swapping and making units at hospitals. Everyone is very unhappy with this idea, as I'm sure you know.
I suspect we may come back to that particular issue after tea.
Yeah, that's true.
However,
I see a chap at the back who's been trying to get in for a while.
Dick Pound, but not the university. You've made a couple of passing references to contemporary neuroscientific evidence, such as data from MRI scanning and PET scanning. And the point I'd just like to make is I really don't think functional localization of the type you're referring to is at all necessary for domain specificity to exist in the sense that evolutionary psychologists are interested in. I think it's a little bit of a red herring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mean it doesn't all have to be in one place for it to be pursuing one function?
I don't think neuroscientific evidence, let's say, does actually, in most cases, lend much legitimacy to the sort of psychological mechanisms which evolutionary-minded psychologists suppose.
I think I agreed with you until I read a book last year by General Antonio Damasio, who you probably know called Descartes' Error, which is really about a group of patients who he's seen over the years with damage to the prefrontal lobe, the place where Phineas Gage got a spike through his head, who all show this sort of loss of emotion without any loss of cognitive ability, which leads them to a whole series of social disasters because they lack the emotion to commit to courses of action. And this seemed to me to be exactly the kind of smoking gun that one was looking for to support Robert Frank's idea that emotion plays its part in committing us to long-term self-interest rather than short-term rational behaviour. Sorry, I'm compressing a huge argument into one short space, but that did seem to me to be a case where you take a bit of neuroscientific evidence and you add it into the cake. I mean, it's not conclusive, but it helps. So,
I take it that when anthropologists see the third possibility of a fishing tribe exchanging after a trip exactly the same amount of the same commodity with each other at the same time.
Right.
This is, you say this was a kind of congenial bonding social custom, like buying each other rounds of drink.
Do anthropologists report that? I don't know.
Yeah, I've seen it in films very effectively.
Really? Well, I certainly, you know, I have no problem with the idea that you would, as it were, artificially trade when there's no reason to do so because you want the social relationship. And Knapp Shagnon makes this point for the Yanomamo that in this case he's not talking about what you're talking about, but he's talking about one band will, as it were, give up clay pot making in order to make sure that it has to get its clay pots from its neighbour and vice versa, so that the two have got a trading relationship which they can call on in times of war and turn into a fighting alliance.
They're keeping up a trading relationship for times when they don't catch as much fish as a jug or something.
Yeah, yeah. Gary.
Gary Russman, Cambridge, Matt. Since you have strayed into anthropology a little bit, and I'm not claiming to be an anthropologist, so I'm a comparative sociologist, a lot of what seems to go on at the early stages of when people start to exchange goods, particularly over longer distances, which they've been doing, as you say, from millennia, is that as well as kind of utilitarian trade, the spheres for access, very early on, they attach high symbolic value to objects, which in the anthropological jargon, they press state or counter-press state with each other. So it's a very different kind of game. It's a kind of imposition of obligations, mm-hmm. competition for status. It's been read, I'm sure you know about it, you know, interpreted by different anthropologists in very different ways. What do you want to say about that? And is that just another strategy for maximizing inclusive fitness, or is it a completely different kind of thing that you're not concerned with, or what?
Are you talking about things like potlatch? And
well, potlatch is an extreme case. And what I'm much more talking about is, well, there's evidence for the beginnings of trading relationships. In the Mediterranean area, you get this lot of archaeological evidence as well. And it just isn't. I don't think you could possibly fit it to your model of people who've been programmed from the Pleistocene very sensibly to say, to be pre-Ricardian right. reciprocators. Yeah. It's a totally different kind of human activity, but it's very common.
What exactly is it, though? I'm not quite with you on that.
If there's an anthropologist here who can talk to the literature of crustacean, that might be great help. But right. You certainly get it in the archaic Greek world. And it's very well documented, both the literary and the archaeological. So, of course, it has elements of potlatch. What people seem to start with very early on is enhancing their prestige by giving yeah. gifts of no utilitarian value and saying, okay, man, what are you going to do about it? Mm. And what you seem to need to do about it is just go up country and get some other object and bring it down to the coast and give it back to me. Now, how does that fit into your vision of knowledge?
I mean, my answer is simple. If we have an instinct for reciprocity, then what you want to do is parasitize it. You want to use it to your advantage by, you've suddenly got a surplus of something, let's give it to him and make him feel under real obligation. and that way I score a point off
that's
it.
That's not a surplus.
Is it not?
No.
Scarce. Ah, yeah, but you are temporarily, it has to be scarce to work, of course, but you are temporarily in command through some successful activity of a sufficient surplus so that you can give it away. I mean, that seems to me the lesson of potlatch is that you're impressing everyone else with your ability to give things away, which is simply a matter of excelling in impressing people. And, you know, in that sense, it's using gift-giving as a weapon. But I don't think gift-giving would work as a weapon if there wasn't the reciprocity instinct. You see what I mean? If you weren't exploiting the fact that the chap is put under a disadvantage by being unable to reciprocate or make
it's a very different kind of game, isn't it?
It is. It certainly is. It's not what I'm talking about, and it's a complicated point, and I think it's I think there's a heap of things like that go on in human society.
Well, you're not tempted to answer as a quote hard sociologist presumably would. Mm-hmm. It's another smart way of maximizing inclusive fitness.
Hang on, Bill's going to say so.
Do you think you have to have one more question and before we have to tea?
Richard,
you choose your own question.
Richard Webb, LSE. Can I return to the incidence of reciprocity and exchange in the animal kingdom? You seem to be suggesting that it's so rare in the animal kingdom because the brains of animals tend to be too small and the neocortex needs to be big. I'm troubled with that because it's as if you found only four or five species in the world that could fly, and you said, well, the trouble is the other ones don't have wings that are big enough. And I just wonder if there's something the matter with reciprocity as a way of life.
Yeah, you mean that if it's only a matter of getting a bigger neocortex, then that's not. Yeah. And which comes first? Very good point. Point taken. But it only reinforces the argument that reciprocity. Well, okay, yes, you've got me, haven't you? reciprocity is. I've either got to say reciprocity is a load of bunk and there's no advantage to it, in which case I've misidentified the important aspect of human society.
Maybe there's a fatal problem with reciprocity. Maybe it keeps being invented in the animal kingdom and the species with it keep kind of going extinct or something because they get it wrong.
Because they invent nuclear weapons or something.
If anyone's got a comment on this specific point, that we could take it. Gentleman with the red jersey.
I'm just a little bit puzzled. The Tom Westerdale from the college. I'm just puzzled. I've probably got the definition of reciprocity wrong. What's going on
Could you speak up a bit?
Yeah. What's going through my mind is things. You've got a whole bunch of bacteria trying to digest a piece of meat. They don't seem kind of fighting each other. They're cooperating. Well, you're going to say they're all related, but then you could have a whole bunch of clones. And they wouldn't be related, and they don't spend time fighting each other. They all secrete their digestive enzymes, and they can pick up from that what's being digested. And then presumably they operate it. And then I'm thinking, do they do different things? Do they trade back and forth? Well, if you have two different species, they certainly would. So wouldn't two different clones also be trading? There's this guy secretes a little more of this enzyme, and this guy a little bit less, but they pool the whole thing. It's all a big puddle of enzymes.
Are you saying that there's no reason why you can't get perfectly good Ricardian comparative advantage between species? And I would agree with you. I mean, that's what symbiosis is. The relationship between a bacteria in the gut of a cow and the cow is just like the relationship between two trading nations. They both benefit.
But if that's the case, then presumably two different bacterial clones are going to be slightly different. So you're going to get this bunch benefiting from what these guys do. Are you telling me it's only reciprocity if this tribe only makes bishops and this tribe only makes spears, or if this one, I was thinking of maybe this tribe makes a few more bishops than spears and this makes a few more spears than bishops and they still trade?
Yeah, no, I'm happy with that. I'm not claiming that it has to be all or nothing, but I don't really see that makes the relationship between two different clones of bacteria an equivalent one. I mean, I think that's still basically a competitive relationship.
I think I have to step in here. Partly because I actually work on bacterial genetics. That's a strange possibility. Like everybody else in the room. And we'll have a talk over tea. But it is now time for tea. It's half past. Would you try and get back in your seats in half an hour's time? And somebody will aim us in the direction of tea. Welcome back after tea. It is actually a particular privilege to be able to introduce Margot Wilson and Martin Daly to you. For a general reason and for a personal reason. The general reason is that they have been the real pioneers of evolutionary psychology, combining a genuine understanding of evolutionary biology and a real effort to grasp that slippery subject of psychology for over 20 years, and they've done, I think, more to turn it into an intellectually respectable discipline than anyone else. And so for that reason alone, it's nice to have them here. As I say, I have a personal reason for being grateful as well. Some almost 20 years ago now, the University of Sussex, in its wisdom, decided to have a course for all psychology undergraduates on the title of Social and Biological Determinants of Sex Roles. And I was Muggins enough to be pushed into giving the biological part of this course, which wasn't terribly easy because my co-teacher did not think there were any biological determinants of sex in the course. No. And I didn't know anything about the subject. I think they picked on me because I was believed to have an obsession with sex, which was probably true. However, I was saved by the Daly and Wilson textbook. But it was a great deal more than a textbook. It not only was an admirable account of what was then known about sex roles in our species, but it also was a genuine contribution to research. I mean, there was just a lot of stuff in there that I couldn't have got hold of in any other way. And so for that and nothing else, I'm grateful to them. They're going to do, I believe, a double act, but they will control their own sort of parts, and that was it.
Thank you, John, and thanks, Helena, and whoever else for having us. We're very pleased to be here. Our advertised title, as you know, is The Truth About Cinderella. I hope most of you can see the slides. That's us, that's our address, that's how you remonstrate with us afterwards by email, should you so desire. And the title, of course, refers to the question about whether Cinderella stories, the stories of mistreated stepchildren, are mythical or whether they have some basis in reality, and if so, what sort of basis. There is Cindy herself doing the ironing while her haughty stepsisters go about the business of being more privileged. And this was, sorry if the image isn't terrific, it's one that Margot pulled down from the web and then turned into a slide from a, ooh, that's too much light, isn't it?
Yes.
Less light is what we need in the front. Yeah.
How come it just came up? Somebody must have leaned on it.
We somebody did something because it's still scene three. Still scene three.
We won't try and show you a bunch of pictures in any case. Almost all the slides are way down blue, so I hope they'll be visible, regardless of what the light does. Cinderella stories are widespread. Stories of a mistreated stepchild who's usually but not invariably the hero of the piece or heroine of the piece. And indeed, the idea of step relationships as less affectionate and investing and perhaps exploitative as compared to genetic parent-offspring relationships, it's iconic, if you like. Whoops, wrong direction. There is the definition of the word stepmother, according to one dictionary. The first meaning is the literal meaning, the wife of one's mother by father by a subsequent marriage. The second meaning is one that fails to give proper care or attention. So if we say that the social sciences are the stepchildren of the federal funding agencies, we're immediately understood. And this is not peculiar to the English language or to some narrow cultural tradition. This sort of metaphor and this sort of conceptualization is extremely widespread cross-culturally. If you look at some folkloric compendium, the classic example is Stith Thompson's Motif Index of Folk Tales in three massive volumes. 40-year-old collection now, you find that, and look up stepmother, stepfather in the index, you find that cruel step-parent stories occur around the world. Here are a few exemplary ones from Thompson's Motif Index of Folk Literature. This you probably can't read. I don't think you'll see too much small print like this subsequently, sorry. But illustrative stories from different parts of the world, cruel bird stepmother, feeds young ones with thorns. Girl persuades her father to marry a widow who has treated her kindly is the flip side. That is to say, the child who chooses a step-parent because that step-parent seems to be less hostile than the other available candidates. Cruel stepmother enchants stepdaughter on the eve of her wedding. Cruel stepmothers often being particularly vindictive about the marital and reproductive careers of their stepdaughters. Dead wife returns to reprove husband's second wife for abusing her stepchildren, that's to say the dead wife's children, and so on. And under stepfathers, Thompson divides the folk tales of the world into two categories for convenience. Stepfathers are conveniently divided into two basic categories, tales of cruel stepfathers and tales of lustful stepfathers. And that catches pretty much what exists in various parts of the world. Now, the ubiquity of this kind of imagery raises the question of what basis, in fact, if any, it might have. But that's not the reason why we originally got interested in this question close to 20 years ago. Margot and I are psychologists by training, but unlike many psychologists, we're in the animal behavior racket, non-human animal behavior I did my PhD work studying rodents, and Margot did her studying monkeys here in London. There are monkeys here in London in captivity. And we continue to work with non-human animals and to consort with other animal behavior researchers. And within animal behavior, about 20 years ago, with what might be referred to as the rise of the socio-biological revolution in the study of social behavior of non-human animals, one topic that people were very interested in was the determinants of discriminative allocation of parental investments, on the idea that parental investment is a valuable resource, if you like, that animals, including people, have evolved to be transmitters of benefits to their offspring, and that this is this is intelligible enough from an evolutionary perspective why that would be so. But parental investment being a costly resource and a one-way flow of benefits in many cases, or at least an unbalanced flow of benefits, parental investment is a resource that's available to be exploited by other individuals of one's own or other species. And animals should have evolved psychological mechanisms, parental motivational systems, which are discriminative with respect to the allocation of parental resources to the benefit of parental fitness, which means discriminative with respect to several characteristics, including the quality of the child and whether investment in that child is wasted or potentially fruitful, and the likelihood, what cues are available to the investing organism that the child is indeed one's own. And there was a lot of discussion of discriminative parental solicitude in various animals, why it's sometimes subverted, why it is that some animals seem to engage in relatively indiscriminate parenting, and can this be understood in terms of their ecology and the lack of selective pressure for certain kinds of discrimination in one species versus another, and so on. And in a seminar in which these kinds of topics were being discussed, in an animal behavior seminar at the University of California, Riverside, where Margot and I were at the time, 20 years ago, where this topic was being discussed, a graduate student raised the question, well, what's the lowdown on, you know, cruel step-parent stories? I mean, is it true that people are discriminative and hostile and abusive and exploitative towards their stepchildren? And, you know, the trouble with, as many of you have been graduate students, you know, the trouble with raising a question in a seminar off the wall about something you know nothing about, is that the person who's presiding says, what an excellent and interesting question. Why don't you go find out and report back to all of us next week? And so this student went away and tried to get into the child abuse literature. It was 14 years since Kempe et al.'s original proclamation of the battered baby syndrome. And there had been a lot of interest in mistreatment of children. There was a lot of research on the topic. There were hundreds of papers, mostly in pediatric journals. And this student tried to nose around a bit. Obviously didn't review at all. But she came back the next week with a generalization, which we're reasonably confident was correct. She said, there's nothing on it. Can't find a damn thing. The topic is not mentioned in this literature. Well, that's sort of surprising and interesting, and that's really what got us inspired to try and find out what, if anything, is the reality about discriminative mistreatment of stepchildren as opposed to one's own children, and about the possibility that stepchildren might be abused, exploited, or otherwise mistreated. And Margot will do most of the telling of the results of the various studies we've done on this topic over the last many years.
Well, first of all, we had to find out where we could get the data to test our hypotheses. And at the time, it was in the newspapers that the American Humane Association had set up a registry where they were going to keep track of all known cases of child abuse. I'm not sure exactly the implications. I think it was fairly applied, and that they thought if there was somebody that was repeatedly abusing a child, that the medical people could check this registry and be more alert for damage. and protect the child better. But I don't think it actually ever served that purpose effectively. And they, in the course of maintaining this registry, they included various pieces of information. It wasn't a great research tool, but it offered us possibilities. So we commissioned the American Humane Association to give us the results of the cross-tabulations of how many children of different ages, of sex, and different conditions of abuse were living in what household compositions. Were they living with their mother alone, father alone, two genetic parents, or parent and step-parent. So we combined this with estimates for the living arrangements of children in the population at large for this American data for the USA, and we came out with these results. On the left, you have the two genetic parent households, and on the right, one genetic and one step parent. On the bottom x-axis, you have the child's age. And these are all cases for children under 17 years and younger, and we've done it 0 to 2 years, 3 to 5, 6 to 9, 10 to 13, and 14 to 17. And that on the y-axis, what we have is a computation of the rate of child abuse according to household composition. And here we have victims per 1,000 children. And you can see, if you look at each age category, each case category, that at all age categories, there's much greater risk of a child who's living in a household with a parent and a step parent of being showing up in this registry. And this case shows that it's the youngest children, in fact, that are at greatest risk. This is an important point to make because at the time in the family violence literature and child abuse literature, people were talking about the role of the child in precipitating the abuse, of the child's hostile resentment of the presence of the step parent, and this creating hard conditions for the step parent. And I don't think that argument will hold in the face of this age pattern. When you look, these, as I said, was the household composition, but if you look at the identity of the perpetrator and look at the risk to children of different ages, the results are even more striking. Here on the left, we have, we called it natural parents, but this is an unfortunate terminology. We now refer to genetic parents because, of course, step parents are natural persons too. But anyway, what we have here is, again, you can immediately see that that on the right, children are at much greater risk of being abused by the step parent, and it's age dependent, again, with the youngest ones. But here, we separated, unlike the last slide, where we had all validated cases of abuse. And in fact, there was well over 20,000 cases in that last slide. And so, this is a large data set. These are strong estimates. And in the top, we've shown you sexual abuse. And you can see the age pattern, if you can see it at all, is slightly different as you might anticipate. And indeed, it is the case that sexual abuse is much more likely perpetrated by a step-parent, but it would be the older children, especially the teenage, pubescent and teenage children that are at greatest risk. In the lower part, I want to indicate that it's not sort of equivocal kinds of abuse, emotional abuse and various things like that. We've got all the cases here of brain damage, hemorrhage, fracture, sprain, internal injury, burns, and cuts. So fairly uncontroversial definitions of what constitutes abuse. In fact, we were concerned about the issue that there might be, because of these sort of Cinderella stories, of reporting biases. And so when we looked at the different kinds of abuse, and we thought that more and more uncontroversial the category criterion of abuse should be, would we see less step parents? Because if it is sort of ambiguous situation whether that really might be of constitute abuse or not, reporting bias effects might reveal that step parents are more often being discovered. And the results are for neglect only in this data set, it was 50% of all our cases that was perpetrated by the step parent. Or identified by in the archive as done so. And in the physical abuse, it was 25%. And in the lethal cases where the child died, and presumably the cases were investigated the hardest, that it was 43% of the cases were perpetrated by a stepfather. So it's not a matter of just reporting biases. The other kind of issue that concerns you, any kind of correlational study like this is, you know, is it really step-parenthood that's driving this, or are there correlated factors like income? We know that poverty is a risk factor for child abuse and neglect. Would it be that the step-parents are poorer families? Well, in that the same year, these are dated from 1976, there was a national survey done in the United States and of the living arrangements of children, and if that study reported that the median income for two genetic parent households was virtually identical to the genetic and step-parent households. Single-parent households, of course, were poor. But anyway, we thought we were kind of convinced in this. We were unsatisfied still that we've, you know, really done a good job in uncovering the differential risk to children deciding that Cinderella's story is based on fact rather than myth. And so we wanted to replicate the study, and we wanted to pay attention to other kinds of possible confounds. So we live in Hamilton in Canada, and we decided to do our own study in our city. And Martin and I did our own population at large survey of living arrangements of children in the city, and we got the data for all cases of severe child abuse in our city, as decided by the two agencies, Children's Aid Societies in Hamilton, that would have been the agencies that would have dealt with all cases of problems with children. So, and these are the results. Again, because of the smaller sample, that the age categories we've used a little bit differently. On the x-axis, we have 0 to 4 year old children, 5 to 10 year old children, and 11 to 16 year old children. And again, it's the same way we computed the rates, victims per 1,000 children. And you can see here, again, the youngest children are greatly at higher risk of being harmed. And here, we also were able to tease apart income variables. There was no difference in the incomes of people in the step-parent households and the two genetic parent households. There also was other kinds of factors that are correlated with this. You might expect when people form a new family and have been married before or had children from another union, and that might be true of both couples, that you might get a much larger family size. You get, you know, greater brood size in non-human animal jargon. And large family size is a risk factor for child abuse. But it only accounts for a tiny bit of the step-parent effect, so that the recomputation of the estimates would reduce the risk to genetic and step-parent households a little tiny bit. Mother's age, very, very young mothers are much more likely to neglect and abuse their children than older mothers, and so again, you might expect possibility of marrying a second time might be greater for women who were much younger. And so we computed mother's age at child's birth. It is a risk factor. Younger mothers, when the child was born, are more likely to abuse their children and to be in these kinds of households. But it didn't remove the step-parent effect altogether. So we tried to pay attention to these various kinds of confounds. Another one that you're probably thinking of right now, is there something different about people who become step-parents? And are they more inclined to be aggressive? They got some other personality attribute that's relevant. Are they maybe their bigger problem drinkers? And in our study in Hamilton and another study that was going on about the same time and independently in the state of Pennsylvania in the United States, they had the circumstance of having a blended family where you had your own children of the present union and a stepchild. And so what children were being victimized in those households? And it was unanimously the case in both studies that only the stepchildren were being targeted with the physical abuse and our sexual abuse. So again, these are small ends, but it suggests that, you know, there's more to it than just the personality factor. And so the other thing we wanted to do was we wanted to look at cases of homicides, where there's no ambiguity about who the perpetrator is because of the degree of investigation, and there's no ambiguity about the criterion of mistreatment. And we have been studying homicides in Canada for other reasons, and we decided to examine the risk factors associated with step parenthood in homicide in Canada. We have a very good national archive of homicide cases in Canada, just like you do here. Unlike here, we have much better estimates of the population of large living arrangements of children. So here, again, let me explain the slide again. We've got the children killed by genetic parents on the left. On the right, we've got them killed by step-parents. The age categories, in that tallest column on the right-hand side, the first column, are children 0 to 2 years of age. And then next, 3 to 5, 6 to 8, 9 to 11, 12 to 14, 15 to 17. And our homicide rates are computed as homicide victims per million co-resident parent-child dyads per annum. And this is the taking into account the number of children that live in step with a step-parent in each different age category. As you can imagine, it's far more likely to live with a step-parent when you're older than it is when you're younger. The risks are very, very high of being, when the child is under, is preschool, of being killed by a step-parent. And this is true in Britain. Here we have data, England and Wales, 1977 to 1990. These data we obtained from the Home Office. They hadn't coded the relationships. They hadn't distinguished genetic from step-parents or any other kind of parental role. We commissioned them to do so since they had the information from the police. They just didn't put it in their archive. I hope that they've changed their behavior since then, but I don't know. Again, we had to lump the years together a bit differently than we did. We got 0 to 4 years of age, 5 to 9, 10 to 15, and that was and the reason we did that was not for any theoretical reason. It was because the population at large estimates that we have for this country are from the General Household Surveys, and that's the way we've got them. We don't have them any other way. And I think it's absolutely clear, like in Canada, there's much greater risk of being killed by a step-parent when you're very young than a genetic parent. There are lots of children, there are lots of infanticides, of course, but most children, very small children, live with parents, with their genetic parents. So that's why the risks are computed per opportunity, if you like. How are we doing? Okay, time-wise? Okay, so I want to switch for a second. I think these data attest to the fact of what we normally expect about parental psychology, filled with affection and solicitude and concern for the welfare of children. That kind of parental psychology is not fully engaged in the case of step-parents. We don't know why. It's really interesting how little psychologists can tell you about the nature of parental affection and the determinants, the developmental determinants over the gestation period, over the birthing and postpartum time, what makes for you convert this little protoplasm into the great deal affection that you feel for it. And that's really an interesting question psychologically, especially for people interested in motivation and emotion. And we don't know very much about it. But what we did think was not only that the parental psychology of step-parents is not fully engaged, but that the emotional, motivational state is probably really different in these situations. We thought that having to assume a parental role to somebody that you, which is a very, very demanding task, and to somebody that you don't love as much as the genetic parent does, that you might feel some resentment. So we wondered if there was any differences, evidence of the kind of mindset of the perpetrator at the time of the homicides, and indeed perhaps whether they showed hostility compared to the genetic parents. And so one thing we did was to analyze the cases, look for qualitative differences in the characteristics of the cases in which a child was killed by genetic parent versus step parent. And we found, for example, the differences in the incidence of beatings to death. It doesn't matter. Let me just tell you, you don't need the bottom. So all we have here are the percent of cases. So it's okay, John, okay. Just leave it. These are killings of small children under 5 years of age by their father. So we've separated the issue of mother versus father. We're looking at the method that they were killed. And on the left, are open bar, children who are genetic offspring on the right with the blue lines are the stepchildren. And here we have the differences in the percentage of cases where the child was beaten to death. And you'll see a huge difference. 80% of the cases are the children under 5 years of age were killed, they were beaten to death in Canada. And in Britain, they didn't use the same category police archive of method of killing, but they used this one. They called it percent hit or kicked to death. They used the word hit or kicked to death rather than beaten to death, but I think it's probably analogous. And again, we get very, very similar results. That's 80% of the cases where the young stepchildren were killed, they were kicked or hit. I think this, on face validity reasons, that it bespeaks hostility. Genetic parents often just, they might gas the child, they might smother, they might not help the baby to live if it's a young infant and a newborn, and that would constitute an infanticide or a homicide, depending on how your law terms things. We thought there might be other clues from really truly limited information available from police archives to distinguish the step kinds of risks from genetic offspring risk and betray something about the mindset. So here are some more breakdowns that we've done. First of all, let's just look, again, it's just the killing of children by their fathers. Look on the first bar. Let's do one bar at a time. Open bars are genetic offspring. The father is more likely to commit suicide in the incident where he's killed the child and kills himself. This, to me, bespeaks despondency and depression. People sometimes, murder suicides are often characterized by people being extremely depressed and despondent. And we know this from literature on analysis of the suicide notes left at these incidents. Another thing that characterizes different between the step in the genetic offspring situations is sometimes a man will kill, oh, we call them familicides, they'll kill the wife and the child in the same incident. And this is far more characteristic of genetic offspring than it is of step. And the mindset from reading the cases is that the wife, I'm despondent, I want to leave this cruel earth. I'm shamed, all kinds of reasons that lead to the really depressed mindset, but I'm going to take my family with me. And the wife and the child are a unit, as it were. Women sometimes have the same mood, and they'll take their child and themselves, but they never take their husband with them. And so here you see the data for the last panel. And that's the case where it was a familicide. You kill the wife and the children and yourself in the same incident. These are very rare kinds of cases, but I think maybe speak a different mindset that characterizes the perpetrator in genetic offspring cases from step cases. And in England, it's almost exactly the same. I didn't give you a transition.
Quite all right. Who needs it? Yeah, we wanted to illustrate with these kind of analyses how you can address or test some implications of the hypothesis that when step parents kill children, it's often in a context of hostility and even hatred towards the child. When genetic parents kill children, which in absolute numbers are even more frequent, although in terms of per capita rates is much rarer, it's much more often, although not always, in a different sort of motivational context of despondency. And there's other evidence of hostility towards stepchildren and other evidence of antipathy in these relationships than the sort of extreme and, one can argue, pathological kinds of manifestations shown in these sorts of data. There's a large body of literature perpetrated mostly by social workers and family sociologists, people who call their field family relations, on step relations versus genetic family corresponding to genetic parent family relations in nice middle class volunteer subjects who have not you know, done anything terrible or run afoul of the law or anything like that. And this literature overwhelmingly suggests that step relationships are difficult. They're statistically more conflictual. People rate their step parents as less reliable sources of support than genetic parents. These effects are large, and they're large in normal families. And we would argue that what we're looking at in these extreme and if you like, pathological cases, is sort of the tail of a distribution or the tip of the iceberg of a distributional difference in parental feeling. That's filicides are like a negative assay of parental affection in a kind of a bizarre one, you may think, but one with some face validity at least. If step parents are hostile towards step children or reluctant investors or you know, statistically more likely to stint those children, to lose their tempers with them, to blame them for the misdeeds that one would not blame one's own child for, and so forth, then it seems likely that this is going to be a source of conflict in the step family, not just between the step parent and the step child, but also between the step parent and the genetic parent. And it occurred to us some time ago that having children of former unions might also be a risk factor for violence against women, if they by their partners, partner violence against women, that having a child of a former union would lead to conflicts within the couple. The woman, for example, perhaps pressing the man to play father to a greater degree than he's spontaneously inclined, the man perhaps finding more fault with the kid than the mother thinks reasonable, and so on. And if that's so, then a source of conflict and potentially a source of violence. There's a lot of evidence from the divorce literature that the hypothesis that this is a source of marital conflict is well-founded. And the kind of thing I'm thinking of is big studies of divorce statistics in the United States, in particular by Gary Becker and other economists, and also by sociologists, White and Booth, in which they found that when you tried to control for other factors, tried to hold socioeconomic and other considerations as constant as sociological data permit, that you find that the marital duration-specific divorce rate goes down with each child of the present union, at least up to 3 or 4, and then maybe it turns up again, actually, for reasons that you can think about for a minute, chew on for a minute. But that it seems that children of the present union are a source of marital harmony or at least continuity. And arguably, from a evolutionary psychological perspective, some would say that as children of the present union are forthcoming, parents become more and more, a couple becomes more and more solidary in their view of the world. The to the degree that they love those mutual descendants, then sort of the optimal states of affairs, the optimal allocations of resources from the perspective of one party become more like the optimal states of affairs and allocations of resources from the perspective of the other party. And long-standing marital couples can become so like-minded as to give you the creeps with their degree of solidarity. The same divorce data indicate that children of former unions increase marital duration-specific likelihood of divorce. Having one of the present union reduces it, having one of a former union increases it, having a second one of a former union increases it some more, having a second one of the present union reduces it some more. And this seems to support the idea that kids of present union are a source of marital harmony, believe it or not, and kids of former unions are sources of marital conflict. So again, we're interested in whether they're a risk factor for violence against women as well as against the children themselves. And deja vu all over again. I mean, we went to look at the, as Yogi Berra said, maybe that's obscure. We went to look at the marital violence literature, and there's a huge marital violence literature, and dozens of putative risk markers for, or risk factors for marital violence in that literature. And at least 5 years ago, paternity of children had not been mentioned in this literature as a possible risk factor for violence against women. There's a big review paper published in the late 80s identifying 89 proposed risk markers for violence against women and how good is the evidence for each of them. Paternity of the children was not one. Well, we had this population at large survey for the city of Hamilton about how the living arrangements of children is sort of base rate stuff. And we have a student who was Lisa Singh, who was working as a volunteer in a women's shelter for abused women. And so, and they did major admission interviews at this women's shelter. And so Lisa compiled an anonymous database on the women who had come to the shelter around the time when we had done the population at large survey for the catchment area of the shelter, and asked about, tried to address the question of whether women were more likely to shop at the shelter, and arguably shop at the shelter because they were mistreated, if they had children of former unions than present unions. So the comparison I'm going to show you is based entirely on women who come to the shelter who have a co-resident male partner who has assaulted them, and that's the alleged reason for their being there, that's the self-reported reason for their being there, who co-reside with an assaulted male partner and one or more own children less than 18 years of age. We're leaving out the people without children, who are a lot of the shelter clients, but just trying to compare paternity within that subset. And, wrong way again. What Lisa found was that, I hope you can see this, women co-residing with one or more own children and a male partner, own children less than 18 years of age. And what the y-axis here is shelter admissions per 1,000 such women in the population for which this shelter was serving. We've divided the women at the median age of shelter clients, 30 years of age, to make the point that a similar pattern occurs in these two groups, even though the rates are different. And what you find is that women who have children by the present partner only are showing up at the shelter at much lower rates than women who have children sired by previous partners. And women have at least one of each is an interesting comparison because there's certainly some hints in the family violence literature, and I think, in step-family literature, not the violence literature, the step-family literature, and I think in common sense, that suggests that this sort of situation might be better, that the conflicts will be relaxed, that when a child of the present union is forthcoming, if the stepfather feels himself to be a bit exploited, then maybe that feeling is alleviated. If the half-sib is enthusiastic about the new baby, and so are both the parents, then they've got grounds for liking each other better, their mutual interest in the child. And there's certainly hints that that's sometimes so, but perhaps disappointingly, there's very little evidence that this sort of situation is an improvement over previous partners only, and both of these bars are significantly higher than this. Both of these are significantly higher than this in this sample of dozens, hundreds, couple hundred shelter admissions. Now, one hypothesis that this kind of data suggests is that, well, maybe the women are not themselves being assaulted more often in these kind of circumstances, but they're quicker to use shelter services in these kinds of circumstances because they perceive the kids as being at greater risk. And indeed, if you ask these women, did your abusive husband assault the children as well, most of these women are reasonably willing to badmouth the abusive partner at this point on shelter admission. So, the women might be prepared to say something negative about the guy that wasn't true conceivably, but still you might expect that to apply across the board. You get these differences that women who come to the shelter answer the question, were the children also assaulted, to a much higher rate, yes, when they have children of former unions than when they have children of the present partner only. And more recently, we've had another student, Karen Wiseman, do a project on the rates at which women are killed by their partners in Hamilton Wentworth. There's only about 1.5 such cases a year in this urban area of 400,000 people, fortunately. so the data build up slowly. But we've done this analysis only locally because no large homicide archive has this kind of information, the reproductive histories of the victims and offenders. You can't get it for a big national archive or even for a big city archive. You can't even extract from the investigative reports of the police departments in big American cities where the police are busy. It's not in there. But we could get this information for the local cases that are reasonably well discussed and reported. And what we found, at the top you see a repeat representation of Lisa Singh's shelter data. At the bottom you see wife killings in the same area over a longer period of time. Just four women who are killed by their co-resident male partner and who have one or more own children living with them. Just considering those women, the rates of being slain by their partner if they have children of the present union only, if they have children of the former union only, if they have at least one of each. Here it does look like there's maybe some gain in this situation, but this is a rare situation and the cases are few, and in fact that represents ACT pace. So I don't want to make a big deal of it. This group is highly, despite the small numbers, this group is highly significantly more at risk than this group in these data as well. We think it important to say, as clearly as possible, that we do not think that we're studying an adaptation when we study child killing or even child assault. It seems fairly clear that, first of all, this sort of violence is relatively rare. We're not looking at something like a male lion who kills all his predecessor's offspring reliably. This sort of behavior is relatively rare. It seems pretty clearly to be costly to the perpetrators, to be a mistake from the point of view of promoting their fitness. And although it's less clear that that is so in ancestral societies and face-to-face societies without state authority, we suspect that's true, frequently true in such cases as well. I mean, killing people inspires other people to think you dangerous, to find you a less good exchange partner perhaps, but to inspire other people with an interest in the welfare of those you kill to feel vengeful towards you. It's nice to manage your social relations within a group, at least, as opposed to between groups, perhaps, without resorting to such extreme measures. And it certainly appears that these people are the tip of the iceberg or the tail of the distribution who are doing something off the curve and wild and non-self-interested in itself. However, we think we're looking at a kind of window on psychological adaptations that have to do with discriminative parental feeling, that it is an evolved adaptation to discriminate in your parental affections and to not simply find any old blob of protoplasm equally delightful and equally worthy of your throwing yourself in front of a train to protect it. You love your own children, and somehow you love your own children, will sacrifice for them, will invest in them discriminatively and in their favor, in the favor of your own. If that's so, there's an interesting question about why the human animal engages in step-parental relationships at all. I mean, we do this a lot. It's been claimed in some sociological discussions of step relationships that the problem with step relationships, the reason they're so conflictual and disappointing, is because they're a novelty, a cultural novelty in the Western world because of high divorce rates. This is not a good argument. I mean, it's an ethnocentric argument. It's also an ahistorical argument. The best evidence we have available is that in the Western world, step relationships were probably more prevalent in the 19th century than they are now, or in the 18th century than they are now, because of not so much because of marital dissolution as because of deaths of still young parents and remarriages. And there's some evidence that step-parental relations have always been problematic. In history, the most interesting study, I think, is Eckhart Vollen's analyses of historical demographic data for Frisia, which I guess maybe is part of Germany where he was working now, in the 1700s, in which he found that age-specific mortality rates of children go up if they lose a parent, and excluding the immediate hypothesis that the parent died of a disease that the kid also gets, getting those kinds of cause of mortality out of it. But more interestingly, the age-specific mortality of the kid goes up again if the parent remarries. You might have imagined that single parenthood is disadvantaging, which indeed it is, but that remarriage would reinstate the resource flow to the kid and make things better for the kid. Parental remarriage apparently made things worse for the kid, at least in Tholen's data. And there are data from societies very different from ours now, the best of which is Hilly Kaplan and Kim Hill's data for the Aceh foragers in South America, indicating that kids who are raised by a mother and stepfather, as opposed to their two genetic parents, simply die at about twice the rate of other children from a variety of causes. It doesn't appear this is all assaultive, but probably they're less well cared for in various ways, less well fed, less often deloused, and in general neglected in the absence of two caring parents. There's a lot of evidence that step relationships are problematic, but also prevalent. And of course, we said these are high risks, and they are high risks, but still the vast majority of step relationships do not lead to violence, or at least no more than genetic parent relationships, or not dramatically more. These abuse cases are, you know, still a small minority of all such cases, and the homicides are, of all such households, and the homicides are a smaller minority. And so it's interesting to ask, why is the human animal such as to be willing to enter into step relationships, perhaps with some reluctance to invest fully in them emotionally and materially? And I think it's interesting in this context to try and think, what do we know about substitute parenting in non-human animals? Because it's not the case that non-human animals simply refuse to invest in alien young. I've got a sort of taxonomy of this topic here, which I think catches most of what we know about parental investments by individuals who are not the parents in non-human animals. And we made two broad categories here, first of all, of what's going on in these cases or how we can understand them in evolutionary perspective. First of all, there are a number of cases where parental effort is being parasitized in some sense against the parental investor's fitness interests, because after all, selection operates on those who have parasitized them too, to be clever parasites. The investing parent is in some sense tricked. The mechanisms of discriminating own versus alien young have been circumvented somehow. Obvious example is specialist brood parasites. Cuckoos parasitize dunnocks. Dunnocks are selected to not fall for this and rear cuckoos. Cuckoos are counter-selected to sneak their eggs in quickly, to mimic dunnock eggs, and to do a bunch of things to try and bypass the defenses. Similarly, you have intraspecific egg dumping. Various ducks, most dramatically, in which some individual manages to sneak a kid into the brood of some conspecific who apparently fails to discriminate. And you have so-called cuckoldry, the issue of males in organisms with internal fertilization failing to detect that they're not, in fact, parents of the offspring and investing parentally in kids who are not, in fact, their own, but were sired by rivals. And we have evidence in some species, including dunnocks here from Nick Davies, his work in particular, I think is one of the nicest studies, showing that this is a selection pressure operating on the parental motivational systems of the animals, so that, for example, male dunnocks allocate paternal effort in ways that are responsive to cues of the probability of paternity of the kids in the nest, but they don't get it perfect. The more interesting case, I think, is to consider, well, are there cases where pseudo-parental investment occurs, where the investing parent has available to it reliable cues of non-parenthood, indeed discriminates, but nevertheless derives benefits from playing parent, and therefore has been selected to be willing to be a step-parent, in effect. And we have a few examples of this sort of thing. We have adopted eggs used as lures to attract additional females in substrate spawning fishes, where a female uses as a cue of a male worth spawning with a guy who's already got a bunch of eggs in his nest. The guy who doesn't have any eggs in his nest yet has to go next door, swipe some eggs, bring them back, spit them out, fan them, stand around pretending to be dead in order to get the next female to come spawn. He's playing parent as for an intelligible reason. Here's Brian Bertram's ostrich story. I'm not sure if there's other good stories about the use of about bringing others into your own brood and peripheralizing them and bestowing a little bit of care in them at low cost to self while treating them as an anti-predation buffer for your own young. You know, ostriches, a single female will incubate the eggs of several females, but apparently her own eggs are central in the nest and are least likely to be taken by a hyena. And arguably, these other eggs actually reduce the risk to her own, although I'm not sure that's demonstrated. And then the most interesting case of all is the case where superficial investment constitutes mating effort. And this has been proposed independently by several people. In anemone fish, who are pair-forming fish in which a male and a female live together in an anemone, if either partner disappears, the suitable nest sites and partnerships are apparently a scarce resource. There's floaters, there's unmated individuals. A replacement individual will come in and will play parent to its predecessor's kids, apparently as part of the cost of establishing an eventually reproductive mateship with the surviving parent. An analogous argument was made by Barb Smuts about baboons. Why are males nice to kids they might never have sired? Because ultimately, why have they evolved to be this way? I'm not talking that they strategize this. Why are their minds such as to do this? Arguably, they've been selected to be nice to the kids of females because they're currying favor with those females. And there's a very interesting attempt by Siebert Rohwer about 10 years ago in Ornithological Monographs to account for the diversity of responses to becoming a step-parent in various songbirds, because you find all possible outcomes. You know, I mean, lots of songbirds have male and female care for the kids together. They both tend best parentally. Either party might disappear, they might get killed by a hawk or something. And then there's a single parent carrying the kids through to fledging. A floater without a territory or a partner moves in and becomes the substitute parent in this context. And in some species, these individuals will kill their predecessors young. In some species, they will ignore them. And in some species, they'll pitch in and help, like a genetic parent. And Rohwer made the argument that we can make sense of this in terms of the mating and territorial market and who's got leverage and whether the surviving parent, whether the available resources and the sex ratio of adults are such that the surviving parent is in the position to demand parental investment before being willing to mate. And he had several predictions from this about ecological correlates of these three outcomes. And the data ran in the right directions with all studies with lots of anomalies and funny things. And this is a topic that warrants further investigation. But in any case, our hypothesis is that this is the best model for the human case. That people are willing to play step-parent because in ancestral environments, one way to establish a mateship of some utility has been to be willing to do this, to be willing to play step-parent. Whether step-parents ever, or typically, come to feel the same sort of parental affection as genetic parents as a function of exposure to the child in the situation, or instead retain some sort of discrimination, some sort of distinction in their mind, some sort of feeling that, you know, when the chips are down, you know, I'll dive in front of the train for mine, I won't dive in front of the train for this one. Whether there's qualitative differences in the psychology of even investing affectionate step relationships as compared to genetic relationships is a question that we think deserves investigation by people who are actually studying psychology in more direct ways than we have been. And we'll quit there.
I'm going to let the speakers field their own questions, but I'd like you to tell us who you are.
It's a long day. Let the speakers escape. Yes, sir, the gentleman in the middle there.
Andy Wells, LSE. I wonder if you have any data about children in adopted families. You know what predictions one might make, but you have a case, of course, where there's no genetic relatedness, but you might very well expect the sort of attitudes that would go with committed genetic parents.
There aren't enough cases, for example, in the homicide archives to be able to do anything with us. We do know, for example, in England, how many cases were killed by an adoptive parent, but very few. So we can't make reliable estimates. The other problem, making reliable estimates, is to know how many adoptive children are out there. So we haven't been able to address this question directly, empirically. I think the prediction would be that there might be no difference in the risk to adoptive children than to genetic family circumstances, and there's several reasons for that. One, that for a very long time here and in North America, it's been the requirement that if you wanted to adopt a child, you have to go through a very severe screening process, and you're evaluated for your commitment, your social skills, your affection, your resources, and all those are risk factors that would, you know, expect you to reduce the effect. And certainly if you read the anthropological literature and historical literature, when you didn't regulate, when you didn't screen who was getting get an adopted child, that you find lots of examples of exploitation, not necessarily, you know, bothering to kill them. You use them for slave labor, for household labor, etc. There's lots of evidence in without screening that, you know, those foster children, maybe not adopted children, are at risk. And there's something else that's different about the step household than the adoptive. In the adoptive household, both parents are not related to that child. In the step, there's an asymmetry. And I think that therefore, insofar as, you know, we're concerned about monitoring reciprocities and things like that, which I think our psychology is well designed for, that here we have an equal footing with respect to this child. The other thing that is not well known that we discovered in pursuing this question is that at the beginning adoption stages, the social workers are monitoring the cases, and there's far more returns of baby than is widely appreciated. And because everybody thinks, I want a family so bad, you know, this is great, and then they realize what an effort it is. And so, you know, this wasn't as much fun as the pet dog. That kind of case we don't find out because the social workers immediately recognize there's a potential problem here and discourage them from continuing.
Well, and indeed there's adoption failures with voluntary returns that select people out. But I think the evidence is, I think if we could shake it out, the evidence would be that adoptive kids do suffer abuse at slightly higher rates, given than two genetic parent kids, given the socioeconomic factor, because whereas adoptees, whereas the distribution of incomes in two genetic parent versus one step plus one genetic parent households are remarkably similar, at least in Canada and the States. Adoptive households are very much more prosperous, and so if you can control for the fact that socioeconomic status is another risk factor, apparently orthogonal to the step one, I think we find that adoptive kids maybe are a little overrepresented in the abuse and homicide samples, but still nothing like the step kids, nothing like that.
I wonder if I could exercise my right to the chair and ask a question, being an exceedingly elderly person. There does come a stage when one hopes one's children will be nice to me rather than me be nice to my children. Is there any evidence on how stepchildren, quote, treat their parents?
There are many more step parasites than there ought to be if you look at parasites, if you look at kids killing parents. There are many more stepmothers and stepfathers among the victims than there ought to be. Although the cases that we've read seem to suggest that these culminate a history of genuine mistreatment by the step-parents in those cases.
Through retaliation.
But no, well, and it's another factor, that the children are likely to protect the mother from the abuse of the man. And insofar as we saw from the data of the risk to the woman with stepchildren in the household, that the stepchildren therefore are greater likelihood of protecting the mother, and that's in that context the man can be killed.
Yes, sir.
What about cases where the step-parents are a relative of the parent? I think in particular cases where the step-parents is a sibling of the parent. Would they be intermediate between the two cases?
Yeah, I mean that would be our guess. We don't have a data archive from such a society. It's certainly a widespread understanding. I mean, Leverett-like phenomena where a widow is married off to her dead husband's brother, perhaps as a secondary and never really cohabiting wife, or perhaps not. These things are fairly widespread in the anthropological record. There seem to be several independent inventions of this practice, and sometimes it's articulated in terms of the welfare of the children, that, you know, in the context, what can you do? In a strongly patrilineal society, in a less patrilineal society, in a more bilineal society, a widowed woman can return to her kin, to her lineages. But in the circumstance where at marriage she has essentially become the property of a patrilineage, her husband's, then there certainly seems to be a perception that marrying her off as a secondary wife, perhaps, or as the wife of the junior brother of the dead man, affords the children some protection. That's a local understanding in some of these cases. I suspect it's true, but I don't know any data set that you bring to bear on that sort of thing.
Ursula?
When she brought the little baby home, she said she suddenly realized that the dog was a dog. And this is what I've been with some experiences that people have told me. I'm a psychiatrist, and so I get to hear a lot of tales of women's lives. They marry a man, and he has this darling little child. Everything is all right until they bring their own child home, when suddenly the husband's child no longer looks like the little darling child it used to. It looks like a horrifyingly large and dangerous rival to their tiny little baby. And it seems to me that if this is true of other people than the ones I've been speaking to, the life of the stepchild should become more difficult after the step-parent has the child of their own in the union. And I wonder if that's the case.
But the only data we had that bespeaks was your admission data.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I made the argument that I might have expected the opposite, that the child of the present union would be a source of harmony for all parties. I understand your argument as well. The only thing I can think of off the top of my head is that it would be interesting to look for birth interval effects. I mean, if 4-year-olds are dangerous to newborn infants. I mean, sometimes people have to put chicken wire over the crib. It's a widespread perception of kids, even in maritally continuous families, that their parents keep bringing along the next damn kid too soon. But from an evolutionary perspective, you would argue that, well, after all, that sibling is of some fitness value, and you should not have evolved to be hostile to subsequent sibs generically, but perhaps to have a different notion from mom and dad of the optimal interval till the next birth. So that if it's big enough, maybe the kid is truly enthusiastic about the younger sibling, and mum is truly unconcerned. And if the interval's much shorter, then the situation is dicier. I mean, that would be a hypothesis that I would look into. I'm not sure whether it's a good derivation to say that somehow birth interval effects should be steeper, or I'm sure you could make some predictions about how they should be different in a half sib versus full sib circumstance if the children themselves are sensitive to half sib full sib cues of some sort. Which doesn't seem to me to be a crazy hypothesis, that you know, the intensity of conflicting with your infant sibling when you're 4 years old might be modulated in response to some sort of cues of full sibship versus half sibship.
There's an article by John Hogan in Scientific American at the end of the last year, criticizing your work, saying that there might be a social confounding factor. Not saying that that your work isn't demonstrating a higher rate of homicide amongst step families, but that there might be a social confounding factor that families with a stepfather, by definition, is more likely to be experiencing family breakdown or disruption or whatever, and that might account for this elevated homicide compared to genetic parents. Do you think there's any validity to that criticism? And if so, has your work been able to control for any of those kind of social aspects?
We ourselves were concerned, as I said earlier, about the differential personality and other characteristics of step parents vis-a-vis other genetic parents, as might be expected on the risk of divorce and remarriage or repeat marriages, this sort of thing. And as I said, we had these two sources of information from Pennsylvania and from Hamilton, that where there was both kinds of children in the household, it was the stepchild that was targeted for the abuse, and the own offspring were spared, which I think is not a strong case, but it's the only case we've got so far without further studies.
It speaks against a sort of dispositional being personalities being confounded, and perhaps speaks against a sort of stress kind of argument as well, that there is this targeted antipathy. Not to say that stress doesn't exacerbate the risks.
Yes, no, I mean, I think that things like alcoholism, like stress, etc., are elevate risk overall, but I don't think that they're going to account for the differential effects that we've been finding.
Question over here.
Oh,
sorry.
One way of getting at that might be through mechanism. I've been trying to think of what a mechanism might be for this. And what comes to mind is, as a reasonably obvious one, is simply not having a chance, not being, is a bonding problem. All of the literature about bonding of babies to kids is actually inverted. It's the parents that bond to the babies. And if the parents aren't around, the longer they're not around, the less likely they are to bond closely. So the step parent is less likely to bond closely. Or the natural parent is less likely to bond closely if he's not there at birth or near birth. Have you looked at rates of homicide or beating among parents who, for whatever reason, we're not able to be near the kid for the first week, month, year?
We can't do that with homicide. I answer that right away.
The beatings.
But we know of. I mean, we are aware and have been of this literature that was very prevalent about 20 years ago, where there was a strong lobbying effort on the part of women to naturalize the birthing process, and there was a number of experiments done on a varying amount of postpartum contact rate, immediate postpartum, and seeing if the results in terms of various behavioral measures of the mother's affection for the child is the function of the contact. So there was this whole bonding literature that developed. It can be criticized in lots of ways. But with that hypothesis in mind, we were really quite intrigued to see the results of a study by an anthropologist, a Darwinian-minded anthropologist, a name of Mark Flynn, who is doing what animal behavior people are used to doing, is that behavioral scan sampling of the people in the village that he was studying. You record where everybody is on a predetermined schedule. You're recording who's doing what and with whom. And from these quantitative data, this is a very unusual kind of approach in anthropology in general. And from these kind of data, he showed that indeed stepfathers were behaving more aggressively to stepchildren than genetic fathers. But moreover, he had very few cases of this, but the case where, this was a place where serial unions occur a lot. The people live in common law unions, and there's a big turnover of husbands. And so a woman's children are sired by, maybe sired by several men. And so And there were, he had cases where the new man came on before the child, while she was pregnant, by another man. And in those cases where he was there for the birthing and for the whole time afterwards, the rates of aggressive action towards the child were even higher than the ones that came on later. So I think, I mean, this is just one study, small n, but I mean, this is the sort of approach that you'd want to take to sort of tease apart what makes for the difference in the experience of being a parent versus a step parent. And that's all I can say about that one.
Bill?
I know you must be aware that these so-called genetic fathers are in some cases not, and I was wondering whether you could tell us anything about the possible connection with the cases where abuse occurs in supposedly monogamous families, and in particular perhaps about whether the child sexual abuse might be connected with this factor.
Yeah. The question, in case you can hear it in the back, was about the so-called genetic relationships, which after all may not be, given uncertainty of paternity, and the question of whether we know anything about whether misattributed paternity, or for that matter suspicion of non-paternity, I guess, has anything to do with mistreatments in the so-called genetic families. We know very little about that, except one does encounter cases of chronic mistreatment of a child in which the man is on record as saying he doubts it's his. Whether they're not actually as prevalent, I think it's fair to say, as we suspected they might be initially. And whether this is, you know, much more prevalent than among, you know, non-abusive people in corresponding, you know, an appropriate control person, we can't say, although we suspect it may be. The issue of whether men are sensitive to cues of probability of paternity, certainly, you know, there's lots of anecdotal evidence of revelations of non-paternity leading to rage responses against the woman probably more often than the child, and to men in some cases sort of saying that, you know, I loved this child for the last 7 years and I discovered it wasn't mine and the affection has turned to ashes in my mouth and blah, blah, blah. But they're anecdotes. We've been very interested in the question. We've been trying to get some student to make a PhD thesis out of the question of whether paternal affection is sensitive to resemblance to self or known relatives in a way that maternal affection is not. It seems an obvious sort of evolutionary psychological hypothesis that if non-paternity has been a problem, a selective pressure affecting the psychology of paternal love, that it might well be the case that men are simply sensitive to perceived resemblance to self in how much they like kids and how they treat them, and that the scapegoated child in a brood of putative common parenthood might be the one who least resembles dad and that sort of thing. As far as we're aware, the question has yet to be addressed. It seems to us a potentially important one. We perceive, probably because we like the hypothesis rather than because the evidence is any good, we perceive a hint in the adoption failure literature, in the adoption literature, that adoption failure is better predicted by non-resemblance to the adoptive father than by non-resemblance to the adoptive mother, which I think is extremely interesting with respect to this idea that paternal psychology is simply qualitatively different from maternal psychology, and even when these people are aware that the child is not their own, nevertheless, men simply respond more to perceived similarity to self than women do, because women did not have this ancestral problem. I mean, I'd love to see somebody do a good investigation of whether this is indeed really the case.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm Oliver Curry, the evolutionist web magazine. Is there any work that's been done into the rate of miscarriage or abortion in the presence of stepfathers or stepfathers-to-be?
No.
But I don't know, maybe we haven't looked properly.
What might you predict in that situation?
I don't know. I don't know if the mechanisms would be there to respond. Yes, Nick, you're going
to
help us?
Well, I think what you're trying to get at is there something analogous to the Bruce effect in mice?
Yes, no, I got the analogy. And I'm trying to think of, I mean, do we have a hint of information about what are all the causes?
The same mechanism we apply to human beings as in mice, to some degree.
Well, yes, I agree, but then the question is in the mice were selected for the physiology of the female to respond to the olfactory cues in the male to make this possible, and I don't know that there's an argument for that in the human case, and I don't know that the physiological mechanisms are such that this is possible, but I'm not an expert on this.
Being pregnant and either forsaken by the sire or just on your own is presumably a stressful circumstance, and whether, you know, whether one could differentiate anything that deserved to be called sort of physiological adaptation in females to be even more likely to abort in the event that they're going to have a substitute father than just from that stress alone would be a formidable task, I think, as a research enterprise.
Of course, the selection pressure isn't the same because when you're looking at mice, the males are extremely infanticidal during the period in which any pups are born that would have been sired by another male, whereas human males only exhibit this behavior in extreme cases.
There's one more question and then I have a few announcements at the end. There's one right there.
I think what you're saying is brilliant and I'm convinced by it for link selection and the selfish gene theory. But I want to know basically what do you think will happen with this information and where will it lead to? Like, will it be into policing people, step parents in the future, or not allowing people to marry a second time or have kids with their people a second time? Do you not think this is a really good campaign for Clinton or Major's family values?
I mean,
what do we do with things like...
Okay, so, I mean, we're scientists and scholars. We value information, okay?
Yeah.
We think it's good to know things. I mean, that might be a wrong assumption. But we value knowledge. And with that presumption, I would think that, for example, women might like to know about these kinds of statistics in terms of evaluating the new mateship. And I think women intuitively do that. Since we've been doing this work, I've been watching my friends, and the future stepfather that isn't solicitous to their child, and they test them in lots of circumstances, is unlikely to be chosen unless there's, you know, other, you know, trade-offs that they're making. And and you can make some predictions about female mate choice about that. But I think the information is interesting for women to know.
Yeah.
The other thing I think is that social workers, they tell us all the time that they are overburdened. Their caseload is phenomenal. There's always funding problems. They just can't be everywhere all the time. If you know something about differential at risk, I don't think that knowing this predicts one case at all. But if it's a piece of information, yet another piece of information that you have, that you combine with all the other information you know in the case, I might be a tiny bit more vigilant, all else being equal, about this family circumstance, this is another. Because as a social worker and I want to keep my job, I'm in deep trouble if the child that I'm supposed to be protecting gets killed. I mean, there's lots of cases recently in our province that's happened. Social workers didn't do a good job, and they're in trouble. So, you know, as a scientist, I value knowledge. I certainly don't think we shouldn't have divorce.
Okay, don't disappear just for a few moments. First of all, I'm asked to remind you that on December the 5th is the next meeting of the connected with these Darwin seminars, which is a Demos launch. But I confess I'm a little vague as to who Demos is or what he is going to be launched into. Can you tell us something about that?
Helena, please. Demos is a think tank, and we here at the centre have edited the latest edition of the Demos Quarterly, and we're having a joint launch with Demos here at LSE on the 5th of December, so everybody is very welcome. You'll be getting full details of it.
Are these for me?
Yes.
To hand out. Right. I also have some small presentations. Don't escape, you two. I've said that these are got names on them.
Where's Matt?
No, it's called Matt. Where's Matt? Come up here. I can't throw it. And here is to Margot and Martin, and knowing to whom presents should be given.
Thank you.
And a present for me too. And my final thing that I have to tell you is that you're welcome for drinks, which will be in the student cafe, and helpful students, stewards, will point you in the generally correct direction. And finally, let's give our speaker a round of applause.